Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. The Minnetonka Footwear Company is facing its past appropriation of Native culture. Part of their effort to be more responsive to Native concerns includes hiring a Native consultant to guide their next steps. And a popular TV show is turning to a consultant to help develop a Native storyline without stereotypes and offensive content. We'll hear about how Native consultants go about navigating the world of business and media. We're back right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has again apologized for missing a ceremony to recognize the country's first ever National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. The day commemorates the troubling legacy of the Indian residential school system. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Trudeau traveled to British Columbia Monday to meet with Native leaders.
The chief of the Tecumlupstisiquepmuc First Nation, Roseanne Casimir, told Trudeau that his visit to her community was bittersweet after he missed an important ceremony on September the 30th. Instead, he vacationed with his family, and that caused anger and disbelief within the community. Casimir said this week was about correcting a mistake and have Trudeau visit a sacred site. She was referring to the 200 unmarked graves found near the site of a former residential school. Trudeau said he deeply regrets his decision to go on vacation, adding that Casimir could have turned her back on him, but instead she invited him back.
After September 30th, she could have chosen to turn her back on me and on the federal government. The community could have said, you know what, we don't need to deal with you anymore. And yet, she reached out and said, please come and listen and learn, and we will walk this path together, and that is why I'm here.
Trudeau said he and his government are committed to doing better. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations was also at the meeting. She thanked Trudeau for coming, but added that now is the time for actual progress, not more words. At least one other chief said he was left frustrated and angry after the visit. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Gabby Petito's case was recently back in headlines after her autopsy revealed her cause of death was strangulation. The national coverage of her case has tribal members in the state where she was found murdered, raising concerns about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Wyoming Public Radio Signa McAdams sat down with two Wind River residents to reflect on their own family's cases.
Missing and murdered Indigenous women's cases often don't get the media attention they deserve. Family members say they see the disparity on social media, television, and other news outlets.
I've seen the numbers with Gabby's case, and I remember the numbers from my sister's cases, and it wasn't shared nearly, not even half as much. So that's really upsetting.
Tiana Wagon has had more than her fair share of tragedy. Her two oldest sisters, Jocelyn Watt and Jade Wagon, were both murdered less than a year apart on the Wind River Reservation. Both cases are still open and no arrests have been made.
But part of me feels like if they just cared just a little bit, or if they just tried a little bit harder, if they posted her story sooner, would have we found my sister alive?
Erica Lambert is from the Navajo Nation, but resides on the Wind River. Her 19-year-old daughter, Tyler Lambert, was murdered by her boyfriend 2 years ago. Her case recently went to trial.
Why didn't my Navajo Nation say, oh, okay, Tyler named him. Let's keep him in jail. Let's keep him because he did this to her. They were going to let him go. But they are on a manhunt for the guy that killed Gabby. And that's really upsetting.
Wyoming's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Task Force reported that between 2000 and 2020, 105 Indigenous people were victims of homicide, and only 30% had media coverage in comparison to 51% of white homicide victims.
We report them missing, but when does it come out into the news? It comes out when we find their body. It comes out in a negative way, and then that's when we get, you know, attention. And, you know, that's just got to stop.
That was Signa McAdams, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Companies have made some major blunders trying to represent Native culture or to appeal to Native consumers. Now, typically, the mistakes come from relying on stereotypes or popular myths. However, in recent years, voices of Native Americans are making their way into more popular culture, largely in the form of consultants. After 70 years in business, the Minnetonka Footwear Company recently apologized to tribes for appropriating Native culture for a profit. They laid out a plan to move away from Native imagery and collaborate with more Native designers. They've also hired a Native liaison to help guide that process. Also, the new limited TV series Dexter hired a Native consultant to help navigate through a Native-themed storyline in their new season. We'll hear about those efforts and get a glimpse at how Native consultants do their job. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are there instances you know of that could have benefited from a Native perspective? Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have three guests joining us on the line today. And first, joining us from Chemeniseng, Minnesota, is Adrian Benjamin. She's a reconciliation advisor, Anishinaabe artist, and local community activist. She is Anishinaabe. Welcome to Native America Calling, Adrian.
Ani, good morning.
Also joining us from Oswegan, Six Nations, actually technically about 15 minutes offside the Six Nations territory, is Caleb Abrams. He's a Seneca consultant for the TV show Dexter. He's also a filmmaker and media artist. He's from the Seneca Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling, Caleb.
Happy to be here. Thank you all for having me.
And also, last but certainly not least, joining us from Portland, Oregon, is Grace Dillon. She's the Native consultant for the new film Antlers and is a professor of Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University. She is also Anishinaabe. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Grace.
Anin.
I can't thank you all enough for joining us on the line today. And since I guess the primary headline making waves right now is about Minnetonka's decision to get away from the Native appeal or aesthetic, if you will. I guess we'll concentrate the first part of our discussion with Adrian. Adrian, turning to you, you're working right now with Minnetonka as a reconciliation advisor. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it was a self-chosen title that they actually thought that it should be my choice of what it was that we do moving forward in every capacity. And I thought that it was quite fitting to try to reconcile some of these relationships with tribes in Minnesota and beyond. So beyond that, we have had numerous meetings. I'm basically in charge of, moving forward this push that we have. And their push to want to do better, meeting with artists, connecting them with some heads of, area public schools that serve Indigenous students or other just tribal nation heads to talk about donation prospects, getting Native designer or artists that may be interested in collaborating with Minnetonka or even for them to just spotlight Native artists in general. We've talked about possibly rolling out a page where they just use their shine, I guess, and, their output in media to put spotlight on artists that may have a collaboration coming out, but just also have their own work in general. And really just trying to look at every aspect of how, you know, this company can do better and move forward and, you know, give some form of reparation. Obviously, like, nothing is ever going to be perfect. And, you know, I've been asked the question, like, what is enough? And I'm only one person and doing the best that I can with what, you know, I think a very forward-thinking company wants to try and give. And yeah, so that's kind of what I've been up to, or the first process of the role.
It all sounds very encouraging. A lot of promising conversations, to say the least, that are being had right now. How were you approached for this particular project?
So I was actually approached by a community elder from the Minneapolis area who had been having conversations of their own in a couple of instances with Jory Miller Scherer and David Miller, who are the president and CEO of Minnetonka. They had been doing their own reach out before I was even involved in the process, kind of knowing that they wanted to do this, not knowing it was time, and not really knowing, you know, how, what to do, who to talk to, how many people was enough. You know, there was a lot of uncertainty that was going on in the process when I came into the picture, and I was approached by this elder. Her name's Pamela Standing. Give her a shout out. Very loving human, and she just kind of said that she had talked to a few different people, and her and I had done some work together and had some, you know, fiery conversations about how we feel about, you know, these different kinds of issues in Indian country. And I think she just knew maybe that I would be a good fit for this. And so she asked me if I would be interested in talking with these folks. And she didn't name the company at first, because I think that, you know, she had probably gotten some other explosive responses or maybe angry responses from other folks that she had mentioned it to. So she just said, would you be willing? And I was like, sure, I'm willing to hear anybody out. You know, I think it's important that, you know, if we aren't going to be the folks to teach about our own histories, it'll always be taught by others, you know. And so that's kind of was my main focal point of walking into this and setting aside my own annoyance and anger with appropriation and everything like that, because I do understand where other activists stand on it. And it's like, you know, another question that I got asked recently was, you know, don't you think that it's interesting that this appropriation concept isn't that big or widely talked about? And I was like, you know, it is for us as Indigenous people. We see it every day. You might not, the media might not, and that's not our fault, but it's the media's opportunity then to make it a thing and to get people to understand it. So aside from this announcement, I think that's the best thing that I've seen thus far, and I'm really excited about the continuing aspects of it, but I'm really excited about what's to come and to know that people are paying attention to it and having Minnetonka be, you know, forthright in this, doing right and really taking a lead and a big step by doing this public announcement. So, that's where we're at right now.
You really hit on a lot of important points in your last statement there. And I think for starters, for example, that these are conversations, like you mentioned, that have been going on in Indigenous communities for quite a long time. However, the rest of the country seems to really be catching up. We could even describe 2021 as the year that most Americans maybe realize that Indigenous people are still here, and maybe they ought to listen up a little bit more. What do you know about Minnetonka's decision to step away from the Native appropriation that was made? How did this come about?
So I know, like I said, they had been reaching out to numerous artists, activists, just I think, you know, heads of community organizations within Minnesota to kind of get a feel of, like, where do we go? How do we move? We want to do this right. We want to do it respectfully. And we want to, you know, really move in a way that the community can move with us, right? That's kind of when I first had the meeting with Jory and David, I really felt I felt that want, right? Like, I think they had known for a long time, and they both have expressed that to me personally, and in meetings with others that we've had, you know, their knowing and also unknowing, and what they've learned through talking with people and hearing people out. And, you know, one thing that I really respected and still respect about them through all of these different phases we've gone through with these conversations, because it's gotten harsh, you know, like on both ends, there's been parts of these conversations with them where they've taken some heat, you know, and I just, you know, it's an awkward feeling to feel that and be in the middle of it, but also it's something that I know has to happen, right? Like, I know that people need to express how they feel about it. And I think that they're in a position where they need to listen, and they know that, right? And that was one thing when I decided to start working with them, or when we were in talks, was very apparent. They were extremely respectful. They were extremely eager. And I think, you know, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, it became really front and center, kind of what you said, right? Like, things just got to be more apparent, and people weren't being quiet anymore. And, you know, I think that they were also, you know, getting some call outs also. And they just, you know, it was like, this is time. And they knew it was going to be a big move for them. And they knew that it was going to cause some headlines. And so, I mean, for obvious reasons, I think that it's hard for anybody to admit mistakes and to especially, you know, swallow your pride a little bit and say, hey, like, we are making these mistakes, but how do we do better? And I guess when I looked at it into some senses, that's what drew me to the project. It was like, you know, I did have my own dismissals, and, you know, you hear it a lot that other companies want to do this, but they don't, they're not committed to it. You know, it's just an apology, and then that's the end of it. And with Minnetonka, I really feel like they're willing to, I mean, for lack of better terms, put their money where their mouth is and really invest in this in a long-term setting. And both Jory and David have said, like, this isn't just for this. This is like, we're going to do this for the life of our company now. We want to make this regular and for Indigenous artists and folks to be a part of these decisions from now on until the end of their company, you know? And so that was the meaningful part that made me, you know that they'd been thinking about this long, long before anything.
Adrian, thank you so much for your perspective. It sounds great that you have the support of Minnetonka. We have to take
The Macaw tribe is one step closer to resuming hunts for gray whales. The tribe has been locked in legal battles for decades, but a federal judge just recommended the hunts start up again. We'll hear from Macaw tribal officials about the importance of whale hunting and their hopes for reviving this cultural and spiritual practice on the next Native America Calling.
Too many do not have access to affordable high-speed internet. That's why AARP fought for the Emergency Broadband Benefit, a federal program to help lower the cost of high-speed internet for eligible households. Those who may have experienced financial setbacks during the pandemic or are struggling to get by may be eligible for a discount of up to $50 per month for high-speed internet or up to $75 per month for households on tribal lands. Info at aarp.org/EBB. AARP supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Today we're talking with Native consultants for products and in popular media. Do you have a question or a comment about the work of Native consultants? You're welcome to join our discussion at 1-800-996-2848. Once again, that's 1-800-99-NATIVE. In the first break, we were talking with Adrian Benjamin. She is the reconciliation advisor for the Minnetonka Footwear Company. Since Minnetonka's decision to move away from the cultural appropriation is what's making headlines, it seemed like a convenient place to start our conversation today. But I guess solidifying that point and in our broader discussion about Native appropriation as we find ourselves smack dab in the middle of Indigenous Peoples Day and, well, Halloween coming up right now, now, it's important to have a broader discussion about the overall representation of Native Americans in the mainstream. And that brings us to our next guest right now. Joining us from Muskegon, Six Nations territory, just on the other side of the Canadian border, is Caleb Abrams. He's a Seneca consultant for the TV show Dexter. He's also a filmmaker and media artist. Once again, he's from the Seneca Nation. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Caleb. How are you doing? Yahweh Scannell.
I'm happy to be here. Doing well.
A couple things to keep in mind. First and foremost, and I'm going to remind Grace of this as well, no spoilers in these movies or TV shows that we're going to be talking about, okay? But without going into any spoilers, Caleb, perhaps we could start with a little bit of background. How did the producers or writers get a hold of you to help with these key aspects of the Dexter storyline?
Yeah, great question. They actually sent me an email last November. They had already written the scripts. They had their story put together, and they were looking for their Seneca consultant. This limited series will feature the fictional Seneca community and numerous Seneca characters. So they knew that they needed a consultant for the project. And I was very fortunate to come up early in their search, and they reached out to me with that offer. So I was reviewing scripts and offering feedback about really trying to flesh out the Seneca characters and Seneca community and Seneca story, wherever possible, make it more accurate, more human in many cases. It was a great process. The writers and producers were very receptive. They surprised me, quite honestly, with how willing to hear my notes and my feedback.
It's my understanding that you've done other consultant work that ultimately helped set the pieces in place for this opportunity. I was wondering if you could give a little bit more background.
Yeah, so when I was just starting in college, I produced a student film about the construction of the Kinzua Dam and its impact that it had on the Seneca people. It was constructed along the Allegheny River and forced the relocation of over 600 of our people. It included my father and grandparents, my uncles, out of my extended family, in violation of the Canandaigua Treaty of 1794. And I produced a student film on this. I interviewed my grandmother, my father, a number of other folks. And it was through that student film that I caught the attention of two PBS producers out of Buffalo. And they were interested in producing a film on that very story. Broader context, of course, the full national one-hour doc. And I was brought on as a researcher first and was later promoted to associate producer of that film. But at the time I was 21, a college student who was feeling inspired by the reaction to my student film, but I still didn't really see, I didn't maybe see a path forward for myself, with making a career out of it. And that project really helped me. It was an on-the-job education, this awesome responsibility, and I imagine one of the projects I'll be most proud of, throughout my entire career. And it was one of the first big opportunities I had.
You mentioned having a sense of the huge responsibility that is on the consultant's shoulders. Do you feel a lot of this pressure when you're doing work, let's say, for Dexter?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the name of that film, the Kinzua doc, was called Lake of Betrayal. And that was in 2013 that they reached out to me. And, man, I couldn't exhale until the film premiered in 2017. So for 4 years, I was proud of what we were doing. I was, trying to do my best to represent our people, our community, my family. And that weight is very much present once again in a different way with Dexter New Blood. It's different this time around because we're not representing a particular community. This isn't Ohio. This isn't Allegheny. And these are characters in a fictional world, in a fictional place. But these Seneca elements are very real. And I do feel an awesome responsibility. It's a great honor to represent our people on this iconic television show. Still absolutely surreal to be a part of it. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I feel the weight of it, absolutely. You know, I want our people to watch this and claim it for themselves. I want them to feel seen by it and feel, I hope that they pick up on the references. And I tried to involve as many of our artists and, you know, people and crafters, wherever we could, to make that, those Seneca elements as authentic and real as possible.
Before we bring Grace into the conversation, one last thing that I wanted to follow up with that, Caleb. But you mentioned that there was an executive decision to make it exist around a fictional town as opposed to a real-life community. What was some of the reasoning for making that decision?
Well, I know that the writers had written Dexter. This is no spoilers. These are in the trailers that are out currently. He's living under an alias in this new town in upstate New York. It's called Iron Lake is the name of the town. It's a fictional town. And so it seemed to follow that any Seneca community that was nearby would also be fictional. But it was also very important to me that it be a fictional community to allow it to be, to give it some flexibility. You know, I wanted to imbue a sincerity wherever we could, an authenticity, but also give it space to be, you know, its own unique place with its own people and its own sort of flavor, if you will.
Sure, sure. Caleb, I appreciate your insights as well. We'll come back to you in just a few. I also want to introduce Grace to the show right now. Once again, joining us from Portland, Oregon, is Grace Dillon. She's the Native consultant for the new film Antlers and is a professor of Indigenous Studies at Portland State University. Once again, she's Anishinaabe. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Grace. How are you?
Doing very well. Mana iti young. We hold each other up.
Dongwaradasak. We help each other as well, and we will remain vigilant. So, Grace, I do have a couple quick questions for you to get you acclimated with our listeners right now. So you worked on Antlers. Can you tell us a little bit about this movie without going into any spoilers?
Sure. It's a horror film, but I think it's a very sophisticated horror film that is engaging in both climate and environmental justice and then the interrelated aspects in our communities with sexual assault and all of the other kinds of things that Winona LaDuke, who wrote a book later on after we had done the film called To Be a Water Protector, I really love her second line, which is the rise of the Wendigo Slayers. And that's really what this film is about.
So when working on a production like this, what does your work look like? Do you read the script and get to make changes, or is it a bunch of discussions? And take us a little bit through that process, please.
Sure. I was first contacted by Scott Cooper, who is the director of the film, and simultaneously Guillermo del Toro, who is the maker and creator of The Spirit Beast. Just amazing. Mm. And they invited me to be a part of this. And at the time, I thought, they'll just talk to me a little bit, and that'll be the end of it. But instead, the script that had been made, Scott sent to me, and he said, please, you know, if there are any changes or any redirections that you would like, let us know. And I went through, and at first, you know, I was thinking, oh, you know, I'll do a little bit here, a little bit there. And I ended up with 16 type pages, single space, of suggestions for changes. And the amazing part of it was is that Scott Cooper and all of the rest of his crew really took that seriously and made every single one of those changes. He let me know. I was also invited to the film set in order to discuss, you know, as they were doing scenes, if there was anything that felt off to me or not. And I was absolutely amazed by that. But I think part of it may have been that Scott Cooper, with his other film, Hostiles, had worked with Chris Eyre, who's Cheyenne Arapaho and just an amazing Indigenous filmmaker himself. And they've just become close friends. And so Chris Eyre actually came onto the set, and I was very humbled by his own mentoring of me. And it was just an incredibly wonderful time.
It has to be encouraging that you worked with an experienced crew who had already kind of had to do this dance a little bit, especially hearing how receptive they were to the changes that you made. Now, let's flip that around just a little bit right now, Grace. Have you heard any responses from other Anishinaabe about this film and how it uses language and the character of the Wendigo?
It will be very interesting. What I had, I could have spoken it myself, but Margaret Newton, who is just a very well-loved and well-admired Anishinaabe professor herself, who teaches Anishinaabemowin, at I think it's the University of Wisconsin or the University of Minnesota. I'm so sorry. I forgot about that part. I think it's the University of Wisconsin. But I actually suggested for the voiceover, there is some voiceover in Anishinaabemowin, and I suggested that she be the one to go ahead and speak that, and she very graciously assented to that. We figured out some phrasing together, but she was the one that actually spoke in the film. So I thought that was another wonderful way of collaboration with our community. And I will be very, very interested to see what they say. Only the trailers are out right now. And we did take some license allegorically with some aspects of the Wendigo. So that will be very intriguing to see.
Following up a little bit on a few particular points that you made, Grace. I want to turn it back over to Caleb for just a quick second. Grace had a great support from the director and producers when she came back to the table with these edits and changes. Now, Caleb, working with the producers at Showtime, did you have a similar kind of relationship, or were there any instances where you kind of had to push back and toe the line a little bit?
Well, like I said, I mean, I always felt supported. I always felt heard. I think the challenge in my case was that the story had already been written. So if I, you know, if it was simply a line or a word that was easy to change, or if I wanted to introduce some Nondawakagaiwanyo, Seneca language in there, that was an easy addition. But something that was more challenging was when I thought that a scene was off base or inappropriate or inaccurate. And the challenge then would be, we need to get from point A to point B and still maintain the feeling or sense of drama that this scene has within it. But now we need to rework some of the pieces inside of it. And to your question, you know, they understood that what I was bringing to the table, you know, needed to be heeded. Like I said, I felt respected, and they always tried to work with me. But then the challenge would be, we still have to make this alteration within the framework of the scene that's already been written. Because sometimes the ripple effect, you know, has impacts later scenes or later episodes. So It was a collaborative process in that way, and was a unique experience.
An ever-changing landscape of puzzle pieces, it sounds like. Grace, did you have any experience like that where you had to go back in and try and fit this jigsaw back together, this jigsaw puzzle?
Well, it's fascinating how Caleb and I seem to have very similar experiences with the support and respect. One thing I would say is that Guillermo del Toro had spent months and months before the filming of creating the spirit beast as it was. And, you know, I believe it's a beautiful allegorical interpretation, but from our stories, our true stories that we grew up with, it was a little different. And the other thing I had to be cautious about is in our tribal nations, we really cannot speak too deeply about the Wendigo, a lot of aspects of it, when Lake Superior is not iced over, you know, like I usually call and make sure about that. And so that was an interesting kind of complication, since it was being done in the spring and the fall before COVID. And it became interesting in that kind of sense. And so really, that's why I think I really love Winona LaDuke's book that came out later on, To Be a Water Protector.
Sure. Grace, I hate to interrupt you. We do have to go to a quick break. I feel very encouraged by this conversation and the future of arts and business with Native cultures. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Native America Calling, I'm your host, Brett Mabee. I'm curious, what are some instances in movies, TV shows, or consumer products that could benefit from talking to Native consultants? There's still time to join our conversation. Give us a call right now at 1-800-996-2848. Once again, that's 1-800-99-NATIVE. In the last break, we were talking with Grace Dillon, the Native consultant for the new film Antlers, and we were also talking with Caleb Abrams, the Seneca consultant for the TV show Dexter. And I don't know about you three, and of course, earlier in the show, we were talking a little bit more with Adrian Benjamin, who's working with Minnetonka right now. And I don't know about you three, but me personally, I'm feeling a little bit of encouragement hearing some of your experiences working inside of the industry right now. I guess this next question is addressed to Adrian. What is the most difficult part about the job that you hold right now?
Did you say the most difficult?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's being as thorough as possible and thinking about things from not just my own perspective, but perspective of others that, you know, I value, and trying to, or I guess the weight of having that responsibility, you know, as much as I agree with what Caleb said, you know, it's a huge honor, and it's also a heavy burden. You know, there's a lot of judgment that comes with, you know, for consultants that do work with, you know, folks that have appropriated or, you know, want to do better and things like that. And I think that, you know, just wanted like the difficulty of self really wanting to just do the best that you can and do the most with that position, because, you know, it is true that there are so few right now really opportunities and, you know, companies or, you know, films, whatever it is, that are really wanting to take these stories. You know, we're seeing it now with obviously Reservation Dogs and everything else, you know, like these folks that are working on, that are also on this show. But as far as, you know, these are new positions and these are new things. And I think, you know, maybe they could echo us in saying that it is a big responsibility because you want to do it right and you want to make people proud and you want your community to really benefit from the work that you're doing. And I think that's, to me, is the most difficult part, is maybe just, you know, being in my own head about it and wanting to do the best that I can. And that's, you know, as much as it's a motivator, it's also makes you nervous about it too, you know, because I think people do judge, and that, you know, it's a new thing, and wanting to do the best that you can, especially with artists. And, you know, with Minnetonka, it's like, it's a big announcement. And like I said, you know, one of the best things about this happening is the light that it's now shining on this, right? You know, we've had the Washington football team argument and all these other things that have come forward, but now it's like, you know, you're actually hearing about people listening and giving these opportunities and wanting to do better. And I think it's a heavy load to pull to want to do better for everyone when you're only one person from one tribe, you know, when there's so many others out there that, you know, deserve just as much. So that's, for me, that's what it is.
Most definitely. Adrian, hold that train of thought. I'm going to come back with another question for you in just a few. At this time, we do have a caller. His name is Melvin. He's from Santee, Nebraska, listening in on KZYK. Good day to you, Melvin. How are you doing today? Welcome to Native America Call.
I'm doing fine. Interesting show because, you know, over the years, you might have seen an Indian in a movie playing a savage or something, and now we got people producing them. Dude, that's so great. We made a lot of steps in this field, and, you know, the other art. You know, my daughter was at the Mall of America and went to Urban Outfitters and seen they had those women underwear with a Navajo, saying they were Navajo. And she wrote a letter to the president of the company stating why that was wrong. And they pulled them. You know, it was just, that need to, she told them, well, there's hundreds of Navajos, and one of them could have did this for you, you know. They could have did this Indian art. And I like to go to art galleries, too, and I really like it when I see all this Indian art now. And it's even better when we can see a movie or a documentary. I would like to know, I read a book years ago about a man named Handsome Lake. He was a Seneca. Are they going to make any kind of stories about him, or films or documentaries?
Well, I'm going to take the liberty of answering that real quick. Melvin, I don't know of any current plans. Caleb, I'm not sure if you do as well at this point. However, I think that could be a great topic of discussion for another day. Going back to your original comment about how nice it is seeing Indigenous representation in movies and televisions, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I think it's long overdue. I've been talking about it quite a bit that, you know, in the 50, 60 years of television and movies, now finally there are scripts being written by Indigenous people for Indigenous people that don't involve Indigenous people just dying. Wes Studi even kind of recently opened up and made comments about when he got into film, the only real role that was available for an Indigenous actor was in a Western. And of course, that's peak stereotype, right? So I guess turning it back over to Caleb, at this time, I do want to direct this question to you right now, mister. How do you see this work that you're doing right now, fitting into the bigger picture of Native representation in the mainstream?
Yeah, great question. Well, I'm very, like I said, I'm honored to have had this opportunity to work on Dexter and continue this incredible on-the-job education that I receive, I've received being able to work with industry professionals. But it also helps me know, it helps me see the value in having Indigenous collaborators as well. No matter how, you know, fantastic my collaborators, my non-Native collaborators have been, there's always a limit to what they can bring to the table in terms of lived experience or community affiliations or simply just, you know, their knowledge of the subject matter. And, you know, I've also been producing an independent film for years now. It's called The Burning of My Cold Spring Home, and I'm really excited to see that project nearing its completion because, and I'm very proud of this, 90% of my collaborators on that project are not only Indigenous, but Seneca. And it's a Seneca story set in a Seneca place, written by a Seneca man. And I'm really proud of that. And I think that my experience on projects like Dexter or, you know, working with my colleagues on Lake of Betrayal, it makes me that much more excited to see, you know, the work that I'm doing or projects like I mentioned Reservation Dogs earlier. You really see the power in those sorts of projects and collaborations after you've had a taste of, you know, working with, you know, a mixed group that way.
I appreciate your insights on that, Caleb. My next question is, I guess, for anybody who wants to take it. So let's take this discussion a little bit outside of the realm of cinema and business, and let's talk about every day. Of course, Halloween's right around the corner. There's always this recurring conversation about having to really strongly encourage people to not participate in the fetishization of our cultures. How do you see this in relation to the bigger picture that's going on, and what kind of insights? How can we get people to understand what it is we're trying to say without just coming off like we're trying to ruin their fun? I should have known a little bit better than to just throw it out there without any kind of direction. Grace, let me ask you specifically, how does that tie into more of this overall conversation of getting away from that kind of appropriation?
Well, it is interesting because this particular film, Antlers, is a horror film. And so therefore, you know, very apt for around Halloween time. And the thing that I'm struck by is the aspect of the Wendigo has already been made very clear by Scott Cooper and Guillermo del Toro in panels, so I can go ahead and mention that. Our old Anishinaabe word for it, pre-contact, simply meant greed. And so in a lot of ways, it then becomes a true story. And I really love Helen Haig Brown from the Chakota Nation because I work with Indigenous futurisms a lot. And when she did her film, which is entirely in Chakotan with English subtitles, we were working through, you know, well, what does this mean? She was asked to create a Indigenous science fiction film. And what she came to the conclusion as I was kind of rambling on and trying to, you know, intermittently explain it, she said, oh, Grace, oh. So what you really mean is taking the fiction out of science fiction. And I've just been really struck by her wisdom ever since, because when we tell our stories, just as it sounds from both Adrian and Caleb, the burden and the responsibility we feel is this is not a myth, this is not, you know, legends, this is not fictitious stories that we're working with. These stories are true, and in my language, Wadabawe, the truth is only as far as your voice can throw it. And my family used to joke around with me a lot, oh, Graves, you have such a soft voice. You know, you have very little Wadabawe. So I'm very conscious of exposing the greed of capitalism and colonialism that overshadows, I think, and undergirds anything that we're working with. And so that becomes important, I think, that the stories that we tell are true stories, no matter what kind of fictionalized setting we might create. And that is part of that heavy sense of responsibility and wanting to work with lots of other Indigenous people simultaneously as you're searching for that true story.
Thank you so much for your insights, Grace. We are fastly running out of time. We do have a little bit more time for one more caller, so I do want to get Jen on the line from East Texas. Jen is listening online and has a question for Adrian. Welcome to Native America Calling today.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I want to say that I am an East Texas Cherokee and to identify myself. And I was, it's such an interesting show as usual. As a writer, I'm learning a lot from these authors and filmmakers. But my question was for the representative of the Minnetonka tribe to the Minnetonka company. I see them on my Facebook all the time, and my response to them, I'm wondering if she thinks my response is the correct response or helping her.
What do you mean? I mean, like comments online?
Okay, my comment, whenever I see them, I love what they're showing me. I want to buy them, but I said no purchasing until the Minnetonka tribe is either receiving funding for this, or the artists are making the work. And I wanted to help you do your job, and if I'd already been doing this, but I don't want to be hurting what you're doing if I'm saying the wrong thing. I'm trying to do it delicately when I am online, but I support what you're doing greatly. And if I can help you by continuing to do that, that's what I want to do. I think you need to have support for you in what you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. So I did talk about that a little bit when I did write a blog post, which is on the Minnetonka website also, about kind of my journey and what I see happening and a little bit of overview of plans. But I also said that one of the reasons why we felt that this public acknowledgement and apology was the first step in this plan moving forward was that so that it wasn't just me holding accountability anymore, that it was public. The public was going to hold accountability to them to keep their word and to move these things forward so that you will see Native design products and Native design fabric and Native design art and, you know, not Native inspired, but things made by actual Indigenous folks. And so just for clarification, you know, Minnetonka isn't a tribe. There's other tribes in Minnesota that they're working with right now being affected have been affected by the appropriation, not just in Minnesota, but nationwide. But yes, so Minnetonka is the company. And I think that you definitely should, and probably some of your comments have been what has led to, their ongoing push to want to do better. So I would say to always hold accountability and that it does take the public and more than even just, you know, even just Indigenous voices, it's got to come from everywhere to hold accountability to these companies and when you see wrongdoing happening. So that would be my answer.
It certainly sounds like there's still a lot of work to be done, but if there's one thing that I'm walking away with from this conversation is that that groundwork has been laid, and it's certainly encouraging for the future of all of Native America as well. Sadly, that's about all the time we have for our show today. I want to express a deep nyawe and thank you to our guests, Adrian Benjamin, Caleb Abrams, and Grace Dillon. We're back with another live show tomorrow. We'll be talking with the leaders of the Macaw tribe about efforts to resume cultural and spiritual hunting for gray whales. Once again, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Brett Mabee.
Keshe, lewe mena ton san flusha ile kwen ap tu keshe ak don tap ton na wan suela ante mo sa tum ate ken na. Yam ton aku amos awa shu ap tu eta tap ton is healthcare.gov kwen awan an ta is ton 1-800-318-2596 an pin an ake nap tu. Luke ya senes for Medicare and Medicaid services ton na wan pen an itu loh ken awe. Ela kwa.
The Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention remind you, receiving the COVID-19 vaccination protects you, your family, and your community, and urge you to please contact your tribal or urban clinic to get your COVID-19 vaccination if you haven't already. More information at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.